Good morning. Good morning. And good morning to you too. This is Law of the Land, and I'm Gloria J. Brown Marshall, welcoming you to another hour to discuss, to empower, inform, and hopefully enlighten, strengthen, and make us go better into this world of confusion sometimes, and still see the beauty and see how we can make a difference. Individually, as a group, as a family, community, how we can make our world a better place, that we're not here just to sit and be in it and have things done to us, that we have the insight, the power, the thought process, the creativity, the intelligence to carve out a place, not just for ourselves, but for someone else, others perhaps, more than one or two, and that we can enjoy this time we have on the planet. Not be tortured and tormented, but enjoy it. That's a revolutionary thought. That's something that we can not just persevere through, but have the power to make happen. We're going to enjoy our life. That is a real strong protest right there for all of us who think that others believe we don't belong here, or that there's nothing else we're supposed to do except work and stay in the shadows. And speaking of the word shadow, we're going to have an excellent guest today who's going to talk to us about the shadow docket of the U.S. Supreme Court. Yes, Steve Vladek, the same Steve Vladek you've seen, some of you, on some of these other networks out there. The other, I won't name them, I've been on them. And he's on our program today, my guest. And that's going to be in a few minutes. But before we go to him, after our musical break, I want to speak to a couple of these things that just moved me in the moments of last week, moved me in ways in which I'm still trying to figure out. What is one of those things you go, what? That we have a submersible of billionaires that goes under, is lost, investigated, search parties, millions upon millions of dollars, taxpayer money spent searching for them as they went on this tourist adventure to the Titanic, the remains of the Titanic. And then to have, at the same time, on the other side of the globe, a ship of people desperately trying to find new lives, a ship of immigrants capsize off of the coast of Greece. Yes, that happened last week. We're not just a few hundred. They're estimating somewhere between 600 and 700 people lost their lives, drowned. And I asked six very informed, intelligent, caring people, did you know about the capsizing of this ship last week that took place at the very moments that we were all transfixed on this little submersible trying to take a tourist guide down to the Titanic? And they said no. Now, this is what concerned me. How is it that nearly 1,000 people drowned off the coast of Greece the same time this submersible was the focus of international attention? And then I thought, and here we have these billionaires, and I don't know for a fact personally, but so many of the 1% refuse or find these scheming ways not to pay taxes, but don't believe in the federal tax system, don't believe in the federal government, don't believe in these so-called programs that are supposed to help others. And yet they have just caused the taxpayers to contribute unwillingly, probably unknowingly, millions of dollars to this rescue effort. and probably more millions of dollars into the year-long investigation of what went wrong. Why are we spending our money through the Coast Guard? And I've actually spoken to the Coast Guard, and they were very nice people in Washington, D.C. headquarters. And I thought, and now they're risking their lives to try to find people who were told not to go in the first place. Not saying that I haven't been told not to do things and I've done them anyway and sometimes gotten in a little trouble, but I'm just thinking the conflict I'm having when the very wealthy who began most of their businesses with small business loans from the federal government then amass these fortunes and then figure out ways not to pay federal taxes, not to pay into the pot, not to groom and support the goose that's laying the golden eggs, making them rich in the first place. And then when they need help, it's the federal government bailing out their businesses. It's the federal government coming to the rescue. It's those federal employees who are saving them, those state government employees who are going to the rescue when these people get in trouble. And yet we are the one putting the money into the pot, the little people, the regular people doing this. So I was just taken aback by that. I'm not going to stay too long because I know we have a full show today. I also know we have our Donald Trump indictment, and some people are saying free Donald Trump. This is not right, and he's being persecuted and prosecuted. And I'm thinking, how much evidence does it take? I remember last week as well, running into a friend of my late husband's who was so happy. He was like, oh, you know, Gloria, you were wrong about Donald Trump. I said, what, I was wrong that he's done these illegal things? No, not that. Am I wrong about the evidence that's supporting the fact that he's done these illegal things? No, not that. I said, then what was I wrong about regarding Donald Trump, that he's mentally ill? No. You said he would be convicted for collusion with the Russians, and he wasn't. And I thought, okay, I have not been able to get anyone who is a supporter of Donald Trump, and not saying you don't support Donald, you support whom you want to support, to actually get me to understand, is this an emotional attachment to this man? Is there something that he represents, symbolizes, that no matter what the evidence shows, there's a blind spot to it that you cannot see it? I've criticized President Obama when he was president. I criticized some of his policies and programs and some of the efforts that I believe fell short. How can you not find any criticism with the diabolical schemes this man has created, or just the blundering negligence, if you see it that way? How do you not find any criticisms? And then to turn around and censor Adam Schiff and then say in advance, we're going to impeach President Biden, just to say it in advance, what is beyond hypocrisy? What kind of convoluted sense of morality is this? How are we using our government? What are your belief systems? I want to find out what the belief systems are behind this cult like mindset that we little people out here have to defend these billionaires, millionaires, these people, because for some reason, what do you think? Some billionaire drops are going to, you know, fall on your head and miraculously you're going to be part of this club. Do you feel an inclusion that you are in that group of millionaires or billionaires just by being a supporter? I'm not quite sure. We know, and I'm going to go to this point next. This is another point on Supreme Court cases have been coming down. The U.S. Supreme Court term begins in October. It ends in, you know, when I say ends, it ends its decision-making process for that term in June. This is the time. This is the month. We're at the end of the Supreme Court term. And so we have a North Carolina gerrymander case that deals with whether or not the the cases before the court in North Carolina can be determined by their highest court, or do they have the ability or power to speak to these federal issues? We have student loans. So those people with student loans, I told you I had student loans, the student loan Supreme Court case, whether or not Joe Biden's executive order on student loans can stand. We have the affirmative action case, and that's a big one. And I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. next week, actually speaking on the affirmative action case, along with doing continued research on my new book. And I want you to, I'll say it at the end of the show as well, hold the date for July 29th, Saturday, July 29th. I'll say it again during the announcements. And my report on the status of Black women and girls. Yes, this time again, for those of you who followed the show over the years, the report on the status of Black women and girls is the oldest ongoing report on the state of Black females in America that is published by the Law and Policy Group. And that will be a presentation. There will be a presentation of the report that will be on Saturday, July 29th. Save the date, and then I'll give you the place as we get closer to that date. We're going to go to a musical break when I come back on the other side. Steve Vladeck will be talking about the shadow docket, how the Supreme Court uses stealth rulings to amass power and undermine the Republic. With truncated briefing, no argument, little or no public explanation, no vote tally to guide the parties before the court or to inform lawyers and lower courts in future cases, and decisions that often come down in the middle of the night, it's hard to think of a better term for the great majority of the Supreme Court's output today than a docket that exists in the literal and metaphorical shadows. The shadow docket. We're here with Steve Vladeck. Steve, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Gloria. It's great to be with you.
We've worked together in the press pool at the Supreme Court, and I'm so glad you're here. I had concerns, but I'm just a little person. You are a CNN correspondent. You have been on the front lines of this, and I need to know. Your book is frightening. And tell us, as the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School of Law and author of other books, why should we be more frightened about the court than we have been in previous decades?
Well, you know, Gloria, I think there's sort of a bunch of overlapping themes. And, sort of get to the book in a minute, I think the biggest theme tying together so many of these current stories about the court is a lack of accountability. You know, we've had a conservative majority on the court in the past. We've had a period of what we might call doctrinal upheaval, when the court has been, you know, very active in scaling back or revisiting prior precedents. Those aren't new. What's really new about the moment we're in is just how little the justices are or think they ought to be accountable to us, accountable to the political branches. And, you know, that really, I think, is a function of the last 25, 30 years. As you know, for so much of the first 200 years of our history, you know, Congress was actively involved in overseeing the court, regulating the court, controlling the court's docket, you know, pulling levers to exert control over the justices. And that's basically gone away. And I think what we're seeing, whether it's in how the court's behaving, what cases they're deciding, what kinds of, you know, rulings they're handing down, or all of these, you know, ethical kerfuffles, I think is all symptomatic of that.
So, you begin this book, and I find it very readable, very accessible for us to understand, and I'm glad that it includes history as well. But you begin with this idea that history gave a small provision that allowed for discretion in the court. And from this discretion, the court has amassed, I guess, from a small part into a monster. What they're doing is when it comes to certiorari and the shadow docket. So first, explain, what is the shadow docket?
Sure. I mean, so when we think about the Supreme Court, when most of us pay attention to the Supreme Court, we're usually focused on what might be called the merit docket, the big high-profile decisions that justices hand down, typically in May and June. You know, we expect more just in a little less than an hour this morning. But the reality is that that's a very small part of the overall output of the Supreme Court. I mean, as you know, most of what the court does is unsigned, unexplained orders that are either turning away efforts to have the court take up a case, that are, you know, changing the status quo while a case makes its way to the Supreme Court. So that's the term shadow docket was coined by a Chicago law professor, Will Bode, in 2015, really to capture that piece of the court's work, which by volume, you know, turns out to be like 99% of what the Supreme Court does. And, you know, Gloria, most of that is not that important if the Supreme Court declines to take up a appeal in a case that really has no implications for anybody. I think no one's going to lose sleep over the fact that the order is unsigned and unexplained. The problem is that this power, the power to basically do so much of their work in the shadows, has expanded a lot in recent years, and has given the court, through all of this discretion, more power. For the first, you know, 100 years of the court's existence, it had no control over its docket. It heard the cases Congress told it to hear and no others. Versus today, where, you know, with like one teeny tiny exception that comes up maybe once a year, the justices are not only deciding which cases to hear, they're deciding which issues to resolve within those cases. And the result is that we have a Supreme Court that's actually doing less work, but the work that it's doing is in cases that are more socially divisive and ideologically charged. And I think, Gloria, that's related to how we got to the point we're in today, where the Supreme Court basically is just doing whatever the six conservative justices want it to do, as opposed to what folks like you or I, or, you know, folks listening might think is what we want the Supreme Court to be doing more broadly.
And I just want you to give an example for our listeners, what one of these shadow docket decisions actually is, how short it is. I think because most of us, and if you have a chance, please, listeners, and I've said this before, go to the U.S. Supreme Court when the term begins in October. It's open to the public, and we're going to go to the Sixth Amendment in a few moments. But the decisions can be read online. But what type of decision are we talking about that's a shadow docket decision?
Sure. I mean, so the two most common examples, one is basically an order that's in legal terms denying certiorari. This is when the Supreme Court says we are not going to take up an appeal from a lower court decision. And those are almost always unexplained. They're always unsigned. I think the orders that I think have more immediate impact, Gloria, a good example is on what's called the emergency docket. So this is when a case hasn't yet made it to the Supreme Court, but a party that lost below wants the justices to step in and adjust the status quo while their appeal goes forward. A really good recent example of this involved congressional redistricting in Alabama and Louisiana. So Alabama and Louisiana both redrew their U.S. House districts after the 2020 census. And in both states, the new maps were challenged on the ground that the states had failed to provide a sufficient number of districts to represent the minority in both states, the black population. So in Alabama, which has a population that's 27% black, the new map had only one district out of seven that had, you know, was a black opportunity district where there were a majority of voters who could actually dictate their policy preferences. Lower courts held that that was unlawful. Lower courts said that Alabama and Louisiana both had to redraw their maps to create a second so-called majority-minority district. And, Gloria, the shadow docket rulings from the Supreme Court were last spring when the court, without any explanation, put those lower court rulings on hold and basically said, we will allow Alabama and Louisiana to use their unlawful maps in the 2022 midterms, maps that meant that in both states you had an additional seat in the House of Representatives, that was a safe Republican seat when chances are, had they been drawn to comply with the Voting Rights Act, they would have been, you know, at least competitive seats and possibly even safe Democratic seats. So right there, you have two rulings that the court handed down last year, both of which were unexplained, both of which were unsigned, that had this immediate effect on the representation of minority voters in Alabama and Louisiana, and indeed even on the composition of the House of Representatives. Those are the examples that the book is really focused on and worried about, because we're seeing more and more of those, Gloria, where the Supreme Court's handing down unsigned, unexplained orders that are producing pretty significant real-world effects.
And when we talk about unsigned, what we are saying, when one reads a U.S. Supreme Court decision, we know who wrote the decision because their name is there. We know who dissented. We know if they dissented in parts. All the names are listed and their rationale for deciding how they decided. What we're saying here is that these are orders that are given and we don't know who decided what. We don't know. I mean, there could be a dissenting decision. And you speak of Justice Kagan, who dissented in a very pronounced way, this whole sense that the majority of whomever gave a particular shadow docket decision, and she wrote a dissent to it. Steve?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes. So that case of Justice Kagan, saying very clearly that she was dissenting to this idea that you're as a majority, is it from the standpoint she's saying there's an obligation to the people to explain what we do.
That's right. And Gloria, that's exactly right. And the case that the dissent to which you're referring was in September 2021 in another really high profile one of these orders where at like 11:58 p.m. on a Monday night, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 ruling in which it refused to stop Texas's controversial 6-week abortion ban. And what was remarkable about that ruling, Gloria, was a couple things. First, you know, the court didn't really explain why it was letting this, at least at that point, clearly unconstitutional law go into effect. You had, as you mentioned, this dissent from Justice Kagan that called out the, you know, five justices in the majority for not explaining themselves, for using emergency orders in a way that would produce such massive effects on the ground. But, Gloria, the other piece of that case that I think often gets lost is it was 5-4 because Chief Justice John Roberts, you know, no fan of abortion or reproductive rights, was one of the dissenters. And that's been one of the themes in these cases, that in a lot of the contexts where the court has used these unsigned and unexplained orders in ways that have had broader problematic effects, actually, John Roberts has dissented. You know, we mentioned the Alabama redistricting case a few moments ago. That ruling was 5-4, again, because John Roberts, no fan of the Voting Rights Act, also dissented. And so I think part of what that shows is that this is not just ideological. This is not just, you know, liberals versus conservatives, where, you know, the complaints about the shadow docket and the complaints about the Supreme Court doing so much through these unsigned, unexplained orders are just complaints of, you know, disaffected progressives. When John Roberts is objecting, when he's saying this is not how we should be behaving, I think that carries even, you know, more force, frankly, than the powerful dissents from Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor, because now you have one of the court's conservatives saying, hey, this is not the way to run a railroad. And, you know, Gloria, just to go back to where we started, this to me is the broader problem here, which is in times past, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, if we got to this point with the Supreme Court, we could have expected a lot of pushback from Congress, pushback that might have actually, you know, exerted a lot of pressure on the justices to moderate their behavior, pushback in the forms of changing the justices' caseload, pushback in the forms of, you know, docking the justices' budgets. There's actually this remarkable episode in 1964 where Congress gives a pay raise to every federal judge except the Supreme Court, because they were mad at the justices. And, you know, that was the relationship that we had for so long. Fast forward to today, where, you know, the Supreme Court engages in this behavior that's deeply problematic, where even Chief Justice Roberts is calling it out, and the response from Congress is crickets. And I think that's a big part of why we are where we are with the current court. Not that the justices are, you know, necessarily acting in bad faith, not that they have, you know, sort of whatever you want to say, the worst, you know, whatever the worst possible explanation is for their behavior. You don't have to believe that to believe that there's a serious lack of accountability, that what's happening is, as a result, is the justices going off in all of these directions where no one is reining them in.
And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. I'm speaking with Steve Vladeck. His book, the New York Times bestseller, The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. You give some examples about how this began around death penalty cases and then moves up to Donald Trump's travel ban. Take us on that short journey. It's a long, deep journey, but we have only about 4 minutes.
Sure. I mean, so the four-minute version, most of this behavior, most of the court's sort of modern approach to these kinds of emergency applications really can be traced to the late 1970s, where after the justices reauthorized the death penalty in 1976, we see, Gloria, an explosion of last-minute requests from prisoners on death row, especially in southern states, for emergency relief from the court, for a stay of execution, so that they can continue to challenge their conviction or their sentence while they're, you know, without being executed. You can't challenge it once you're dead. In response to a flood of applications from those kinds of death row prisoners, the Supreme Court changes its procedures in ways that are now really starting to show up. So for the first time, Gloria, started in 1980, the Supreme Court begins handling emergency applications as a full court, as opposed to having the single justice who has geographic responsibility for that part of the country handle them. That means that the court stops holding oral arguments on emergency applications. They used to before 1980. It means the court stops writing explanations for emergency applications. They used to before 1980. And instead, in the 1980s death penalty cases, we see the rise of these full court orders, whether blocking executions or unblocking executions, that are neither signed nor explained. That had been the sort of the focal point of that kind of ruling, the death penalty, throughout the 1980s, the 90s, the 2000s. Gloria, you ask anyone who clerked on the court right during that period what they remember of the shadow docket, and they would say they remember the death cases. It's really only in the mid-2010s and only once you see a huge uptick in requests for emergency relief from President Trump that this pattern, these pathologies, start expanding into all areas of domestic policy. And just one data point really quickly to illustrate just how profound an effect Trump had. So between 2001 and 2017, you know, that's the Bush and Obama administrations, two very different two-term presidencies, the federal government, the most common party in the Supreme Court, only asks the justices for that kind of emergency intervention a total of 8 times. That's once every other year. In 4 years, Trump goes to the court 41 times, and the court grants relief. They rule for him in 28 of those cases. And so that really is where we see what had to that point been a death penalty specific series of problematic behaviors hit the mainstream on everything from the travel ban to the border wall to COVID mitigation measures to congressional districts to elections. And so, Gloria, what the book really tries to tell, it tries to tell the history of how the Supreme Court gradually, you know, claimed more and more power to rule in these kinds of ways, and how, starting with the Trump cases, we see that power being used for rulings that are directly affecting all of us to a far greater degree than ever before.
Direct and affecting all of us without having the responsibility to explain to us and the lower courts. So now we're without a measure as to what we can and cannot do as lawyers, as courts, as citizens of this country, because without an explanation, the legal rationalization for why the court or the justices ruled a particular way, what guidance, and which is one of the major things the court is supposed to do, what guidance are we to get from these shadow docket decisions?
Well, and that's the problem. I mean, I think there are two different issues here. The first is when you don't have an explanation, that means lower courts, it means government officials, it means, you know, you and I, right, can only guess as to why the court has ruled the way it does. That obviously has really, really problematic effects going forward for those who are really just trying to do their best to do whatever the Supreme Court says the law is. But, Gloria, there's a second deeper problem, which is, you know, providing a principled justification is not just important for giving guidance. It's also important for separating the judges and the justices on the Supreme Court from politicians, right? What makes the Supreme Court a court is that the justices are providing principled justifications for their decision-making. Not necessarily that we're going to agree with their principles, but at least we're going to agree that they are principles. And we're, when you have more and more rulings producing broader effects on the ground where there are no principles, and where if you actually look at the overall body of rulings, there's no even sort of unspoken explanation that tells you why the court's ruling this way in case A and that way in case B, when instead what it appears is that the justices are voting, you know, their policy preferences, and they're not providing any rationale to countermand that, that's where this becomes a symptom of a really, really big problem, where now you have the justices, even more so than in the big merits cases, even more so than on abortion or affirmative action, you have the justices really looking like they're just politicians, voting for some policies, voting against other policies, and not deigning to provide a neutral principle justification that would allow for a, you know, similar legal argument from a different political actor to have, you know, to have force in the next case. That's why I think in some respects the shadow docket is actually an even bigger part of what's wrong with the current court than even the most problematic decisions we see on the merits docket.
Justices voting their policy preferences as opposed to actually applying the law and then being held accountable for the decisions that they make. Is it possible that they fear repercussions of deciding? You speak of Justice Alito saying that we, the outside people, are trying to delegitimize the court. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, you know, when she was like, "Oh, we're not political hacks." Do you think they fear the pushback from the people who then can look at that particular justice and say, "You decided this way," as opposed now they can not just use the shadow docket to have their decisions or their policy decisions, but they can use the shadow docket to hide in the shadows?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of them do and some of them don't. Gloria, I think we've seen in the last, you know, 16 to 18 months, a little bit of moderation in the behavior of, you know, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. They're not voting for emergency relief as often. We're not seeing as many 5-4 and 6-3 rulings on the shadow docket. We're seeing more cases where, you know, Justice Alito is dissenting and is angry about it. So I think there's been some movement on that front, and I think that's actually a pretty good sign unto itself that the court is, as I at least think it ought to be, amenable to public pressure and public criticism. But, you know, I think the problem is that for the most part, these are Band-Aids. And they're Band-Aids that are only going to sort of temporarily cover over the far bigger problem here, which is that, you know, we have a Supreme Court that has basically become completely unchecked, where it's deciding fewer cases every year, where it's deciding only the cases it wants to decide, where the justices are, you know, keeping their own counsel about whether or not they're complying with the relevant financial disclosure and ethics rules. And so part of why I wrote the book is because I think, you know, the more that we talk about the Supreme Court as nothing other than the sum of its merits decisions, the more we miss out on all the ways in which, as an institution right now, it's actually pretty unhealthy. And all the ways in which part of that, you know, unhealthiness is a function of a breakdown in the separation of powers. It's not that, you know, it's not that the court shouldn't have power. It should. But that power is meant to be checked. And I think the shadow docket is a symptom of how unchecked the court is. I think the merits docket and some of the cases we're going to get handed down this week are a symptom of how unchecked the court is. I think all these ethical reports is a symptom of how unchecked the court is because, you know, when you are a Justice Thomas or a Justice Alito, you don't have to look over your shoulder to worry about what ramifications might, you know, occur if you accept this trip or that present. And, you know, we ought to live in a world where they actually are worried about what's going on behind them and where they are a bit beholden to Congress. And and that's a big part of why I wrote the book, was to put into context where this court is today compared to its predecessors, and how the real way to understand that is not by looking at the, you know, big flashy merits rulings on affirmative action, abortion, guns, as big a deal as those are. You know, that's the bread and butter of what the court's supposed to do, but rather to look in the shadows, to look at what the court's doing when we're not paying attention. So I think there's just as much to see, if not even more to see there.
And so as we conclude, I wonder, did you write this book for the court, for the people? Who was your reader when you were thinking about this book?
I mean, honestly, I really tried, and I'll leave it to others to decide if I succeeded. I tried to write this book for, you know, for everybody. You know, the book is meant it's meant to be accessible to non-lawyers, even though there's a lot of technical legal stuff in it. It's meant to be interesting to lawyers. I mean, I think even lawyers who style themselves Supreme Court experts will have a lot to learn from the book. And, you know, if the justices happen to pick it up for their summer reading, it's meant to appeal to them, too. Because I think, you know, Gloria, part of the problem is that I think we spend so much time having different conversations about the Supreme Court, depending upon who the audience is and what the context is. And I feel like if we could actually just have one sort of broad structural conversation about the court, not about whether, you know, Dobbs is right or wrong, not about whether Bruin is right or wrong, but about whether the court as an institution is acting in a way that we think it is supposed to act, whether the inner branch dynamic between the Supreme Court and the executive branch and the legislative branch is actually what we would want it to be, regardless of who the current justices are. If we can have that conversation, I think we're actually going to come out of it a lot better. And so I really wanted the book to stimulate that kind of conversation about the court, a conversation that I hope we all both feel like we can and want to participate in.
Thank you, Steve Vladeck. He's the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School of Law and author of The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. I hope you'll be back soon.
Thanks, Gloria. I'd love to be back. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, riveting conversation with someone who is one of the brightest legal analysts covering the U.S. Supreme Court for CNN. And we'll be right back after this musical break. Think about this conversation on WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I am with another guest who is the president of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, ASALA, the organization that was founded by Dr. Carter G. Woodson, the second African American to graduate from Harvard with a PhD in history. And the issue on the table is what we're doing in Florida. The question has been that Florida has had a travel ban or travel advisory, and this is what we're going to talk about today. What is it that we can do, since the Association for the Study of African American Life and History has its conference scheduled in Jacksonville, Florida in September, and we have a travel advisory by the NAACP? I'm here with Marvin Delancey. Marvin, please help me and the listeners best understand what they should do with this travel advisory of the NAACP and how it affects those organizations like ASALA with events that were already planned to be held in Florida, and for those people who have maybe vacations of African descent and other people of color in Florida. Help us understand. Thank you for joining me to do that.
Sure. My pleasure, Gloria. I want to explain that one, ASALA had booked our conference in Jacksonville, Florida for 3 years in advance. And so, of course, this travel advisory, gives us some pause, but we decided that we're going mainly because rather than running away from Jacksonville, Florida, we decided we'd run to it in order to challenge Governor DeSantis to work with the people there, the African-American community in particular that's there, in terms of promoting African-American history, saying that we will not be intimidated by, you know, some of his policies and decisions, and in general, saying to other African-Americans, even though there's this travel advisory by the NAACP, we need to go there to fight for justice, to fight for the teaching of our history and culture, and indeed to support the African-Americans that are there.
And this travel advisory from the NAACP was issued on May 20th, 2023. And the NAACP Board of Directors said that Florida, quote, is openly hostile toward African Americans, people of color, LGBTQ plus individuals. Before traveling to Florida, please understand that the state of Florida devalues and marginalizes the contributions of and challenges faced by African Americans and other communities of color, end quote. And so I was in Florida in February for Black History Month. During that time period, one of the presidents of the college down the street from the college I was speaking at the time had been replaced, taken away, summarily just dismissed by DeSantis's people. Governor of Florida, DeSantis, has decided that this anti-woke sign legislation, this anti-woke legislation, when they don't even define what they claim woke is, this all-out assault on the teaching of Black history, of diversity programs, of having us actually discuss American history that involves enslavement and these issues involving race. And so ASALA has at its core a mission to inform people about the history of African Americans in this country and abroad. So why don't we very quickly speak to the mission of ASALA and why it's so important for people to take into account the travel advisory, but still attend this conference?
Yeah, again, since our mission is to promote the study and research of African American history and culture, you know, we would be remiss if we didn't go to Jacksonville, Florida, to talk about these issues, again, to follow our mission. You know, we've decided, just based on what we know, for example, Carter G. Woodson, our founder, that he would go to work with the local communities in Florida in order to promote and, again, research the history of African Americans. And so we're hoping people will come. Because so we're going to do several things. We're not just going to go into Jacksonville and spend a lot of money and leave. We're going to go there and work with the local community. You know, we have three strategies that we're going to do in order to assist the local community there in terms of supporting, teaching, researching African American history and culture. First of all, we're going to do an old style community meeting the day before our conference begins at one of the local churches. Again, this is harkens back to the civil rights movement in terms of what they used to do in terms of planning strategy. They didn't just sort of sit around and wait and suffer from bad policies. They met, they rallied and planned strategy in the local community. So that's the first thing we're going to do once we get there on the Tuesday of our conference. Then on Wednesday, we're going to have several sessions at our conference dealing specifically about how people can resist the DeSantis mandates and policies that tries to stop the teaching of Black history and, of course, stop the addressing of things like slavery and racism and discrimination and so-called wokeness. Then, of course, we're going to do a read-in. We're going to read banned books at James Weldon Johnson's park on Thursday, just to deliberately, you know, challenge this whole notion that certain books shouldn't be read by our children, as well as other people who are not of color. Then, during the entire conference, we're going to have sessions that address how to teach African American history without going to jail. Or without being fired from your job, because indeed that is a strategy that we want to pursue and show to the people, particularly the teachers in Florida, that they can't stop teaching our history, but there indeed is a way to do it without going to jail.
And when you say without going to jail, because there are like signed legislative policies in place for schools and colleges, as well as for people who are working with schools and colleges, that have severe consequences for teaching Black history, for discussing enslavement, for making little, you know, Sally uncomfortable to hear about what has actually taken place in this country. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. According to some of the legislation that has been passed against wokeness and don't say gay and so on, it's a third degree felony for teachers to teach things that they have earmarked in the legislation as being uncomfortable for young white people. So, as I said, what we're going to do then is work with teachers to show them how to get around this law that makes it a third degree felony to teach woke material. And again, we're talking about simply things such as slavery, the civil rights movement, racism and discrimination that they feel will make white students uncomfortable. But again, as I said, what we plan to do is show teachers that you can still teach this material without going to jail. Okay.
And the theme for each year is set by ASALH, ASALH.org. The Association for the Study of African American Life and History, AS, as in Sam, or study, ALH.org. Please go online and become a member. So these themes are set each year by this organization that was started by Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who was also the founder of what began as Negro History Week and became Black History Month, based on the fact that Frederick Douglass and President Lincoln both have their birthdays in February. That's why. So that's the Jeopardy question. So you have the answer. Why is Black History Month in February? And the theme this year is resistance. So coincidentally, ironically, the theme for this year is resistance.
Yes. And it's right on time, as they say. It's a very apropos, because what we're doing is resisting what is happening in Florida. And that's, again, that's why we're going. That's what we're running to the problem and the controversy, rather than running the other way, staying away without getting involved. You know, we're following John Lewis's sort of mantra of getting into good trouble by going to Florida, promoting African-American history, and, again, making it very public with our community meeting, with our read-ins at the park, and again with the sessions that will teach teachers how to teach African American history.
And just to give those dates again, we're talking about our conference in September, and with as I've said to many of you over the years, for clear understanding, I am on the board, the executive council of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. And I want to also note that the conference is going to include the presentation of papers by scholars on all aspects of African-American history, especially as it aligns with the theme of resistance. And one of the areas, as you know, with my study of Queen Nzinga in Angola, my trip to Angola, I've just returned in the last 3 weeks, doing more research there. So there are going to be papers, there are going to be discussions, all different things that are happening in our last moments. Marvin, tell them, just give them a scope or feel for what they'll gain, in addition to the fact this is a travel advisory from the NAACP, not a travel ban, if they decide to come to Jacksonville, Florida for the ASALH conference.
Okay. Again, the dates of our conference in Jacksonville is September 20th through the 24th. But as I said, on the Tuesday before the conference actually begins on the 19th, we will have the big community meeting with the members of the community in Jacksonville. In addition to the academic papers that will be presented, we have a film festival. We will have vendors who will sell books, and clothing, and jewelry. As I said, one of the great things about Asala is that it's not your traditional African-American or your traditional history conference, in that we reach out to people in the community. We bring in the vendors. We bring in people of the local community so that they indeed can benefit from all of the people who will be coming from across the country to attend our conference. So we will have plenary sessions that are open to the public. We'll have three luncheons in which we're bringing in some of the top scholars. I won't go through all of them. But they will indeed address some of the key issues that we are talking about and discussing across the country about wokeness and critical race theory and so on. So, again, our conference is not just an academic conference. It is one where, as I said, we'll have a film festival. We have several receptions that we plan. We have those luncheons. And it's just a great time. Just one point. I always tell people, when I go out and do presentations, that they need to join Asala, because if they come to our conference, not only will they learn about African-American history and culture, but they'll get a chance to network with people from all across the spectrum, not just historians. And I also say, where the traditional history conferences, I go there and I sleep through the sessions because we're reading papers to each other. But at Asala conferences, there's so much going on in terms of the interaction, in terms of the film festival, the different round tables, and of course
the trips to the museums and other mm-hmm. types of yes. sightseeing that takes place. That's part of the conference. Exactly. It's really, we become an integral part of the community, and anyone can come. You don't have to be yes. African-American to come, but you right. learn more about African-American history, because African-American history is American history. Thank exactly. you so much, Marvin, for joining us. Cool. And that's once again, asalh.org. The conference mm-hmm. is September 20th to the 24th. And W. Marvin Delaney, is our president. Our president. And thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you, Gloria, for the opportunity to promote the conference and get people to Jacksonville.
Okay, then. See you Thursday.
Okay.
Right. Thank you so much. And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. That was W. Marvin, or we call him Marvin Delaney, who is the president of ASALA, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. The conference is September 20th through the 24th in Jacksonville, Florida. There is an NAACP advisory, not a ban, but an advisory. And that's what I wanted you to take from that. And hopefully you'll go on our website and learn more about this upcoming conference. This is the end. Oh my goodness. This one, save the date, July 29th is my announcement. Saturday, the report on the status of Black women and girls will be presented. July 29th, Saturday, the time will be given and place soon, but save the date, mark your calendar, and look for Law of the Land podcast, Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall podcast. It was so great being with you, and I want to see all of you on the radio.